Sanchez. I went and talked to him, mm-hmm. and he named a couple names, and I wondered if they were familiar to you. Adela De La Torre.
Mm-hmm. She was, currently she is chair of Chicano Latino Studies, and she's in the health science area.
Uh-huh. So was
she's
she,
on campus.
Do you
well,
remember
she's new.
She was around then?
Oh, no, no, she's new. She's new faculty.
Okay. Okay.
She's just been here a few years.
Okay.
I'm sure she's not full professor yet.
Okay.
So you got to be here
I
at least.
Look that up.
Yeah, I'm sure. No, she's just been here a few years.
Okay.
She just came from, well, let me see. Does it tell in the bulletin?
I think it tells in the, yeah, in the catalog.
When you came. And, but she's very recent to the campus.
Okay.
Go ahead. What else are you going to ask about?
Oh, and Rudy Torres.
Yeah, Rudy is also very new. I knew Rudy.
Oh, okay.
I knew Rudy back in the days in East LA when we were both active in class of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And let's see. And he also is new, Delatore. Okay, now let me check by my name what that year means. Does that year mean when you came?
I think it means when you were hired.
Yeah, I think, well, I'll know by looking at what
right.
year they have behind me. They have 88 behind her.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was hired in 75.
Okay.
And Rudy Torres, I think Rudy came about the same time. Well, McCray was president, I know, when Rudy came, because he came as an assistant to the president, and then he became faculty. He didn't like that term. Let's see. Came in 89. He came a year after Adela.
Okay. So, what classes in those early years did you teach?
I was teaching in education, and it's cross-cultural schools in U.S. society, and I was also teaching developmental reading in high schools, and then over in Chicano Studies, I was teaching Chicano education and La Chicana.
So, were you familiar with what was going on? You were, like, up on and involved in what was going on, like, in Chicano Studies
mm-hmm.
before you taught this class. So, were there women active in with all of that? Like, were there...
No, because it was so...
Because
the only woman who was really in the department was Genevieve.
Oh, what about students? I'm actually...
About students. Oh, yeah. I think they were always both males and females.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. But in terms of professors, it was males.
Okay.
Except for Genevieve.
Okay. How did you come to campus here?
How did I come here to campus?
Uh-huh.
Very interesting. I'm from L.A. I wanted to teach at Cal State LA. While I was getting my doctorate at Claremont Graduate School, I worked part-time for Cal State LA. I taught in their secondary ed program at the supervised student teachers. The department chair wanted to hire me when I finished my doctorate, and so he approached the dean on it. He was unhappy because the dean said, well, we can hire her, but only on soft money. Soft money means that you get a grant and they can pay your wages, but it's year by year, you don't know whether you have a job, and you don't have tenure, you know, you don't get tenure. Okay. So the dean wrote me a letter from that college offering me money under the grant they had, Title VII federal grant, and he said, you know, we aren't able to offer you a tenure track position, but we want you to work with us, of course, and each year we'll find money somewhere to keep you. Meanwhile, I had checked out over here, which I knew nothing about, and at Cal State Long Beach, they offered me tenure track. Oh, God, it was such a dilemma because I wanted to work in L.A. I mean, I taught in East L.A. I mean, you know, that was where I lived and everything. So I wanted to work with that community, and you came here, we wouldn't work with East L.A. I ended up moving because it was too far. It would kill me to come from way over there. But anyway, so it was back and forth. And so I finally decided I wanted to change your track, so I was going to come here. And I had to come and bring my contract signed and turn it into the president's office. Well, I got a call from Cal State LA. Why haven't you turned in your contract? And I says, because I decided to work for Cal State Long Beach, not Cal State LA. Why? And I said, because I want a tenure track position. They offered me one. And so, this was the dean, and he said to me, well, when are you going to sign that contract? And I said, I'm going to leave in just about half an hour, go to Long Beach and sign it. And he says, will you wait 10 minutes? Don't call, just wait. I said, yeah, I'll wait. So I waited, and he calls back. He says, I talked to the president, and he's allowing me to offer you tenure track. So, you want to come to Cal State LA, tenure track? And I said, no, I need 10 minutes. And so I had to think about it. And I was very angry. I felt like I'd been treated like a burro, like a donkey. You told me in writing that you could not offer me tenure track, and that's why I got this, and every year I'd be up in the air, did they rehire me? And I said, and then when you find out that I had a chance to get it somewhere else, then you were able to give it to me. And I really felt betrayed and misused. And I felt, if they treat me this way to get me to come, how are they going to treat me when I want to be promoted, when I want tenure? Then play games again? So I said, no, I'm going to Cal State Long Beach. The dean at the time who was here said to me that he knew that other dean, and they each knew that they had offered what they'd offered. And he told the dean here, he said, I should have bet him, because he wanted to bet me that you would go with him even though he'd given you less. Because he says, I know she loves Alain. I know this is where she grew up, and this is the community she knows and the school she liked to work in. So even though I don't have to offer as much, I'm sure she'll take my offer. And he wanted to bet this dean that even though you give her tenure, she'll come to us. And he says, I guess I should have taken him up on the bet, huh? And I says, I guess you should have. But that's why I came here. That's why I came here. And it was, I was really angry at how I've been treated. And, you know, I felt it was like being deceived. I thought, how can you put in writing? I said, no way could you give me tenure crap. And then the minute I say I won't come, then you can get things right. 10 minutes, and he calls me back and says, I got permission. I can give you tenure crap. So that's how I come back here.
When I read the description of the La Chicana in 1979, mm-hmm. it used the word Chicana feminist movement. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, where do you see like the more traditional, or however you want to say, women's liberation movement in terms of the Chicana feminist movement? Or would you call it a Chicana feminist movement?
Yeah, I would call it Chicana as opposed to being just feminist.
Oh, no, as opposed to being, well, I'm kind of asking, where do you see, like, Chicana activists in terms of, like, the women's movement, the Chicana movement, you
okay.
know?
Okay, well, I think that you're going to find all different kinds of people, obviously, right? But what I do think that among what I would perceive as being the Chicana feminist, I'll give you an example of someone you may have heard of, who to me now this is a Chicana feminist. And someone like Gloria Molina, who's a personal friend of mine, she and I started this child care center, first bilingual child care center in East LA, and still going. And she helped found, and I was a member of Comisión Femenil, which is a feminist commission, which was a Latina group, and we used to meet in LA. And Gloria Molina epitomizes for me a Chicana who's a feminist. She is a strong woman. She's worked very hard. And you know, one thing that to this day amazes me is how she doesn't realize her own worth. For example, one thing that she always felt so bad about, she never got a college education. She went to community college, but she never went out and got a MBA, you know. She went to work. She was secretary. She was one of a very large family. Her father was a janitor in a public school in L.A. And from community college, she went to work in staff clerical work. And then she got into politics, and she went to work first for Art Torres, and then went on up, you know, to different things in politics. And she's always been very strong, very closely tied to the community. She is a woman, but she doesn't just speak of women's things. You know what I mean? Because that's the difference I see in the Chicana feminist. Mm-hmm. We're very communal oriented. And although she's very supportive of women and women across colors, you know, she's a very strong supporter of Barbara Boxer. Worked very hard in her campaign. You know, she's worked for a lot of women. When we ran her first election, when she ran for the assembly in East LA, and you know, we just didn't know how we were going to do because there were a lot of the men who were out there twisting arms not to support her, and you know, a woman can't be a leader. You know, she's one of the very first. And what we did was we got a lot of women to come in and help us. And these are women like from the west side of town who weren't Latinas, you know, Jewish women, other women who were supportive of women and came in to work for us to help Gloria. And then another thing we did when we to get out to vote and to go and talk to people, we targeted women voters. We went for women voters under 45. Because anybody over that probably wouldn't like a woman as a head either. You know, so we went to younger women, younger voters. And she won. And she defeated a male. And it was wonderful. I've always worked in all her campaigns, and you know, she's to me an example of a Latina who to me is a Latina feminist. But when you hear about her, it's on communal causes that she's working. She really got in bad luck with the Democratic Party because she would not support the jail in East LA. They wanted to put a new jail there, and boy, she got the grassroots and she fought for them. And the Democratic Party leaders wanted her to back down because this was one of the little deals they made with the Republicans, because Antonovich did not want it out in the desert, which was his district. We thought, why not in the desert have a prison? Instead, right by all these schools, you know, to put a prison. So, but that's one thing that the community loves about her. She's a grassroots person, grassroots fighter, very strong. And so she's an example of what I would call a Chicana feminist. And there are many others too, Grace Napolitano. A lot of my friends are in politics, so those are the kinds I know, you know.
So, for yourself, would you describe yourself using feminist?
Oh, yes, I consider myself a feminist, absolutely. And see, it depends on what you. It's sort of like.
It's such a big difference.
Yeah, but like for example, take the word liberal. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a liberal. And people have so misused that name and stained it, et cetera. But like, I love the quotation from Adlai Stevenson, one of my heroes from history. And in fact, I had made a beautiful scrolled thing of his saying. It's in my living room. And Adlai Stevenson said, a liberal is a person who believes that it's people who are important, and that all people are equally important. Now that to me is what a liberal is. And so in a sense too, I think that sort of moves into what I think a feminist is. One who cares about all people and wants equity for all. And it's not against males or anything, but wants doors open to all. And that all includes women.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of myself as a Chicana, the focus is for equity for all women. And it's sort of like from Stevenson's thing, all women. You know what I mean? And that all women don't have to be alike. You know, we aren't tainted or lived the same. And so that just as who we are is different, so our struggle is different. Because I really do believe that that whole idea that we have to fight sexism within the context of racism is just so essential. You know, and if you would say to me, which is the greatest ism you have to face, it'd be hard. Is it? Because sometimes when I've had to face put down, discrimination, whatever, it's not always clear. Is it because I'm a woman? Is it because I'm Mexican? Or is it because both?
Uh-huh.
You know, when you get some negative from people, or treated in a way you don't like, the respect that you don't deserve, or when people, what I hate the most is when people will flatter you, quote, in a way that's a put down. Like, everyone's wanting to go speak to the department chair, and there was a male professor there. And we both sort of came up, and so he was sort of like, well, who do I talk to first? And he says, oh, well, you want to talk to Consuelo, because of course you always want to talk to the one who was beautiful first, right? Oh God, I hate that. I just hate that. And I said, no. I said, no, if you want to reward that, I will accept it. I won't accept that you just said, but I will accept if you tell him, if you want to talk as you always would, to the most intelligent and the most articulate of us too. That's fine, I'll buy that. I'll take that for myself. But see, that's something that just grates me when men compliment you on things which you know damn well they don't mean one way or the other. It's like seeing you down like you. I hate it when they use beauty and they do it at banquets and stuff. Now we get to see it from the beauty, right? And they'll say that of any woman, whether or not she has any physical beauty, they'll just use it. Mm-hmm. That's how you compliment women. You see how they're beautiful. And it becomes it's so unmeaningful because they use it for everybody. Ugly or not ugly, you know, and everybody gets that. But what about on qualities that really matter? You know, qualities of competence, qualities of intelligence, etc. Well, you don't hear them say that. So, those kinds of things really violently when I hear it done. But, and so, in terms of myself as a person, I know I have had some hurtful experiences in my life, and some have been because I'm a woman, some because I'm Mexican, I'm sure some because of both. Mm-hmm. And, you know, get both.
In this seminar that I'm taking, mm-hmm. we're working with expanding, like, or deciding whether we're going to use feminist or women's liberation movement to, like, expand it to include more groups of activist women, you know, and we're dealing with, you know, how did that come about? Was it through, like, kind of first their role as mothers and, you know.
Now, what do you mean more groups? I understand.
Like welfare rights. Involved with welfare rights, women, like groups who weren't traditionally called feminist or part of them.
But that's what I'm saying is the difference. Among us, they were.
Uh-huh.
Among us, they were. See, among us, it's those basic community issues that brought us out. And so when I think of some of the finest feminists that I've known, women from the community, and I think of some wonderful women. They've been leaders in welfare rights, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how they work out their feminism.
Uh-huh.
And that has been, I think, a difference. Because from the start, that's the way we've been. It's only been more today with the younger woman, et cetera, that you see more the Latina Gloria Steinem type. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
More just feminism on feminist, strictly women's issues.
Right.
But our base always has been that. You know, when I think of some of the women, like I think of one right now, you know, in welfare rights, and she certainly has always been considered one of the top, quote, Latina feminists. And her thing is all welfare rights.
Right.
Welfare rights for mothers. You know
right.
what I mean? But
right.
So that's the way we do it to begin with.
And I think we're also kind of dealing with how to include, you know, all of these women who we would probably think are feminists, but then how to distinguish them from maybe people, like active women with religious convictions that work against things that we would think are, like, important, like, things to women, like, issues to women's
like abortion rights.
Right.
Like a woman who's pro-life, and yet she's a strong woman fighting for
right.
that. No, that gets to be hard.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
I think that also is not only that we are visible for being activists in certain issues, but that there be an understanding that we're not all going to live out our lives the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one person who considers themselves feminist and feels that you can only do A, B, and C, that you can't hold that as what another woman should do. So,
right.
That won't be.
Like strict rules.
Right. It has to be more flexible.
Right.
And I think when you start out with a movement, you tend to be more rigid and you find things very narrowly. And I think that's where there was a lot of misunderstanding and clashes between the white women and minority women. I think much more so than now. But at the beginning, boy, really a lack of understanding of each other and a suspicion of each other. Because you look at white women, you say, yeah, sure, they're women, but they're white. And so, you know, because we're constantly thinking of the racism there. Mm-hmm. Just because they're women doesn't mean they're not going to be racist. So there's always, you know, that distrust, et cetera. And I think part of it is, too, because we live in a segregated world frequently, and we haven't learned how to be comfortable with and know others. For example, I'm in a program called Partners for Success, in which I have mentees, and I have Latino mentees, and most of them are female. And one thing that really surprised me, and I myself never thought of it, for many of them, coming to this campus is the first time they're ever with whites. They've never been with whites in school, never. And they feel very alienated. And it's sort of like, you know, I'm not really a student here, miss, you know. I was a student at Huntington Park High, and I was an A student. They come here and it's different. They're students, I'm not. I'm watching. And so it's that thing of working with them to say, hey, you're a student too, and you can be part of this world. But see, they're not comfortable because they're with people they never were with before. And so what do you see? You see pockets of isolation, right? Well, like I remember when I was a teacher at LA Unified, I didn't have my doctorate yet, but I had a master's and I had a credential. I'd been a teacher, and I had to do an in-service for the district for teachers called Mexican-American Child in the Schools because we were integrating. And so teachers were not going to have Mexican kids. We never had them because the kids would be bused there. And I remember I taught a class in the Valley, and we had this thing, the Valley. Oh, my God, how awful. So I had to go teach and hear all these white teachers. And however, it was okay because he was on my own turf. I was in charge. It was a classroom, and they were my students. You know, I had a little secure there. I remember when I first got that assignment, I thought, oh, my God. But then the interesting thing happened. It was a really nice group and got along real well and had a whole semester. And so at the very end of the semester, they decided, let's get together and have a party after the final's over and everything, you know. Because they had college credit and everything was out for the class. And,
it was a high school?
No, these were teachers. I was teaching teachers.
Okay.
And they were required, it was what they call 33.3. All teachers were required to take a course about a culture different than their own. And this was one course they offered.
Uh-huh.
Mexican-American Child in Schools. So I taught that, and for LA Unified. And so these were all teachers in LA Unified, white teachers who taught in the Valley. And so they decided on a Saturday night to have a party. And so I went out there, and I went out on my own, and this was married. So I went alone, but I'm way out there. And then I got to the house. Oh, my God, it was a mansion. Couldn't believe it. Well, it was because of her husband's job, not because her job was a teacher, you know. Gorgeous home. So I walked in, she answered the door, the woman whose house it was, and she answered the door, and I was in the foyer, and way in the back on the side was like a den, you know, where everybody was, you know, talking and things. And all I kept thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to talk about? How am I going to say it? What am I going to say? You know, I just really felt, because at that point in my life, I had never mixed with non-Latinos. We all had friends were Latino, and I was used to being among them, you know, because see, it's different when you're a teacher over adult. Because it's, you know what I mean? It's your turf. You're in charge. But here it was going to be on an equal footing and in a social way, which I wasn't used to being socially around white people. You know what I mean? And here I am with a master. You know what I mean? To think that I felt so insecure. What was so funny was the woman who asked the door says, do you want people to sit here while and talk? And I said, no, fine. And then she says to me, she says, you're really nervous, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I am. You're scared. I said, yeah. And she said, you know, there's something you told us in class that I didn't understand or even believe when you told us, but now I do. She says, we talked about the fact, you know, their fears and et cetera, being around minorities. You know, they share that. And then you shared about how minorities felt that way about whites. And of course, you know, she couldn't believe it because white people are so nice and safe and good, you know, that no one should feel uncomfortable. And she said, and I could not believe that could be true. But she says, you really are. You're very nervous about going in there with a room of nothing but white and social ambiance. And I said, yeah, that's very true. I do. And see, that I think is part of, too, what has gone wrong when we as women haven't been able to come together, is that we've been apart, we develop wrong notions about each other. We don't know how to interact with each other. And it's only as we mix, then we can become more trusting and accepting of each other. And I think with many of us initially, we lived in a woman's world, but with a Latina woman's world. And it didn't include others, and therefore we were uneasy and suspicious, et cetera, of others. And I'm sure we're both ways. So I think that's been one of the problems. But and there'll be more and more opportunity for mixing as we do have more Latinas get educated, et cetera, because as this happens, they will be in the workplace, et cetera, where they will mix with other people that if they just stayed at home, they wouldn't mix with. You know, you could just, like, you know, when I live in East L.A., shoot, I never had to use English. I remember once going to Panaderia, bakery, and there was a flyer then. It was about these courts, set of courts that the government was doing something about. And I asked the woman if I could have a copy, because I wanted to read it, what it said, from this, you know, neighborhood throwaway. And she says, oh, señora, she told me in Spanish. She says, no, no le puedo dar uno. She says, I can't give you one. She says, you can't use this. I said, why? She says, we're all out of the ones in Spanish. All that's left is English. And she says, so what would you do with it? I said, I can read English. You can read English? She was shocked. I was teaching at the time in L.A. Unified. But see, because I came in as a customer all the time, but I always talked to her in Spanish, and she assumed, like many people in the community, that I didn't speak English. You know, but that's the thing, that when you're isolated and don't move out. See, I did move out because I was teaching. So you go to the teacher union meetings and stuff. You know, that's how you begin to intermix with people. But that is a concern, too, that when we don't interface, we need to do that. Anything else you want to ask me?
I don't think so.
I hope I've given you enough
info. Yeah, you have. What is your feeling? Do you think that Dr. Ramirez knows about the course's development also, or probably not since you've taught it?
No, I think she just turned over to me. Because we talked about it. I can't remember. So I remember I was chair, and I went to you, and you know, like I told you,
okay. That
she said, tell her, she says, you can tell her what I know, which isn't that much. She says, I just asked you to teach it and then develop it, write it up. And I'm sure it's evolving.
Did the students help you write it up?
No, I wrote it out. Okay, but because the faculty have the right of a thing to turn in, you know, get approved. But, and I'm sure it's evolving and changing as times change, because I'm sure if I were teaching today, I would teach it very differently, because we have a different population. And I would make it, instead of La Chicana, I would want it to be La Latina, and look at the experience of people from Central America, et cetera, to include their heroines, et cetera, you know. It's just important. But when I taught a pretty homogeneous Latino population, it was pretty much Mexican America, but not anymore.
Okay.
In fact, that's why they changed the name of the department. It's now Chicano Latino Studies.
Uh-huh.
They just changed it a few years ago.
Uh-huh.